So you inspired
me. Okay, and welcome edition of In and Out of Sports in the Coach's Corner with Coach Butch McAdams. And this show is sponsored in part by our friends at Horton's Funeral Services, Dr. Edward T. Buford, and the Athletic Republic. And as always, powered by our partners, the African American Athlete.com. And that means my producer, he is Rick Hampton Sr. Well, folks, in the Coach's Corner this evening, we simply have the best. And if you were around the DMV, that's District, Maryland, and Virginia, basketball in the 70s, the mid-70s, this guy needs no introduction. All I'm going to just say is, shoot! And we're talking about simply the best. He is Brian Maggett. Hey, Brian, how are you, man? And I love it, man. Hey, when you step on the court at University of Maryland, the fans would just holler, shoot! How did you like that, Brian? Was it, was it a distraction? Did it motivate you? How did you receive that?
Well, that's a great question. But first of all, thanks a lot for having me on. I appreciate it. It's a pleasure. And I listened to your show and enjoy it very much. So it's an honor and a privilege to be on. That's a heck of an introduction. I actually have a funny story about that. But
okay.
To get to your question, I mean, a lot of people would think, gosh, how did he, like, react to that and all that? I mean, I loved it. I loved it because – I mean, the 2 years I was at Maryland, Lefty put me in. That's what he wanted me to do is shoot. So, and that's what I could do. So it was not sort of like a bother at all. It didn't really get to me. But the funny story is a really good friend of mine growing up claims that he's the one who started it. And he was so afraid. True story. My friend Neil Moskowitz. True story. He was so afraid to tell me that him and his brother were the first ones at the very first game my freshman year to start yelling it because he thought it bothered me and I would get mad at him that he only told me like 2 years ago. He goes, hey, it was me and Saul who started that whole shoot thing. So I said, why didn't you tell me before this? And he's like, I thought you'd be so pissed at me for starting it, But – come on, it's like the greatest. It's the greatest story. Come on, it's awesome. I loved it.
And I also, in terms of stories, starting off, I've got two quick ones. One, researching you and John Lucas used to play one on one, and Luke would tell you, "Hey man, when you get in the game, get open, and I'll get you the ball." True story.
Well, that's some really good research right there because. Actually, I used to go over to Maryland when I was a senior at Blair. I would drive over and play with those guys, and I got to be friendly with Luke. I mean, we weren't buddy-buddy where we go out or anything like that, but my freshman year when he was a senior, pretty much 3-4 nights a week, we'd go over to Cole and play one-on-one. It is true. I mean, you talk about, like someone who gives you confidence. Here's a 3-time All-American. Every time you go into the game, he says, get open and I'll get you the ball. So, yeah, true story. I loved Luke. Luke was awesome. I mean, how great was it to play with a guy like that and Mo Howard and Brad Davis and that whole crew? It was just a great experience.
And another quick story, which became like folklore, besides fans hollering, shoot, was that, and I think this started down at Duke. I'm not certain, but you can correct me. I think it started down at Duke when a fan came on the court doing warm-ups and put a dollar or two on the floor, and this was maybe 25, 30 feet from the basket, and you hit the shot, and put the money in your pocket or you pick the money up. Again, confirm or deny.
Well, no, I can confirm, and there's another cool backstory to that. I befriended, or Billy Packer befriended me at the time.
Yeah.
'Cause one of the things I liked to do was go out before warm-ups and shoot around. You know, we get to the arena like an hour and a half before the game, and warm-ups weren't until 30 minutes. So if given the opportunity, I always like to go out and shoot. And so the game at Duke that you're referring to, I was out there. I was the only one, too. And, you know, what they say about the Duke fans being crazy, it's all true. And there was like 300 or 400 of them there an hour and a half before the game. So I'm shooting around, and, you know, they're not giving me a hard time or anything. But sure enough, a couple of guys came down and put dollar bills on the floor. And, you know, at the time I didn't do anything. But the funny thing is that Billy Packer is seeing what's going on, and he tells his guy to film it. So right before I went into the locker room to do the pregame, you know, I went over to the $2 bills, and, yeah, I sank the shots, and I stuck them in my pants. And my friends back home, when I got back, they said, hey, man, did you know that they showed that whole thing with the dollar bills before the game? And so yeah, that's true. And I actually have my pop, bless his heart and rest his soul, he saved all my stuff. I still have his dollar bills.
Wow. Oh, boy, this is going to be a great one. In the Coach's Corner, we're talking with Brian Maggett. And, Brian, anyone who knows you knew that you had such a great love and passion for the game of basketball, to the extent, and we'll get to this, where you and a friend, you guys would do what we used to do in the old days. You would sneak into a gym just to play basketball. I mean, sneak into the gym. If there were a crack in the door or a crack in the window, you would find a way to get through and, you know, not do anything destructive or disruptive, but just play some
right.
hoops. But let's talk about Brian, let's talk about the origin of that great love and passion for basketball. How did it start?
Well, you know, I grew up at a time where there really wasn't any youth basketball teams per se. So actually the first team I played on was when I was 13. You know, before that, we were just playing pickup in the neighborhood or up the schoolyard. You know, we played baseball, football, basketball. And in seventh grade at Eastern Junior High, I met a kid named Bobby Shear, who was a really good player himself. And he told me, hey, man, you need to come over to Silver Spring Boys Club. You know, we got a team over there. We go all over the area and play. And they were in the Beltway League. And that was the only game in town. So I went over there and made the team in seventh grade. And it was great. We used to go down and play police boys clubs. We played Hillcrest Heights Boys Club. I mean, all this great competition for someone who's never really, like, played before. And, I mean, Bobby was sort of ahead of his time as in seventh grade. He was probably the best seventh grade player, or one of the best seventh grade players around. He evolved really quickly. And he told me, man, you got to play every day. He goes, this is not like a casual thing. And I sort of took it to heart. And from that point on, I mean, I played baseball for a few more years, but basketball was really it. And, you know, I don't think I really developed an obsession for it until maybe like, you know, a couple of years later where, I mean, you get up every day and okay, how many hours are you going to play today? Where are we going to play? We're going to go down to Sligo. We're going to go to the Armory. We're going to go to Hillendale and you know, get some runs in. And then how many hours are you going to shoot around? And it just became like that was your life. That's what you thought about. You thought about playing hoop, going to school, and, you know, I mean, hanging out with your friends, obviously. But
sure.
Yeah, it was and you know what's interesting, Coach, is that it doesn't matter what your background is. Like, let's say specifically from around here, I grew up in Montgomery County. There
That's
are
right.
kids like me in PG, in D.C., in Virginia, who have the same kind of obsessive sort of thought about the game. And they're getting up every day like I am, where am I going to play today? How many hours? Like, you know, am I going to get in? Am I going to get enough shots? And I mean, it wasn't an unhealthy obsession for sure. It was great, you know, as long as you didn't like do it at the expense of everything else, which, you know, at the time that's what we wanted to do. And that's what we did. So that's really when it started. But one, I can't believe you mentioned the story about breaking in sneaking into the gym. Because that's what it was then, sneaking. Now it would be considered breaking in. You'd probably get in trouble.
That's right.
My friend and I, Bart Bakke, he was a 5'7", crazy, crazy competitive athlete. And our sneaking in was a little bit more premeditated. Every Friday, we would go down to the Blair Fieldhouse, which was a separate building, and they had a tree outside the weight room, which was on the second floor, a skinny little tree. And we would unlock the window of the weight room so Bart could climb up the tree into the window and then unlock the door every Saturday and Sunday in 74 from September until January. We would go in the gym and play like full court one-on-one for hours and hours and hours. And the best part of the story is Tom Boswell wrote an article in the Washington Post. And the article was about me and Barry Frazier and Steve Castellon and a female basketball player in Virginia who I can't remember her name. And it was about that. It was about the obsessive nature and the passion that kids had for basketball. And he led it off with this story. Well, the downside of the story is it appears in the paper, Coach, no kidding, on a Monday, all right? And Coach Doan, who's our coach at Blair, is quoted in the article saying that, yes, I know Brian does this, and I know that he knows that I know he does this, but nothing is ever said about it. Well, you know what? We had an athletic director who read the article, and that afternoon they cut the tree down.
Well, back then, and again, maybe public schools were different from the private schools or the Catholic schools, but we would give individuals like yourself a key to the gym. I know Coach Morgan. Morgan gave Adrian a key to the gym. I had a couple ball players, Tony Dobbins. He had a key to the gym, and you know they were responsible. And so, we'd give them a key to the gym. But even if it weren't a gym, you would find a way, a hoop, be it Sligo putting a quarter or whatever to keep the lights on, or Hillendale, you would find a way to get some shots in. There's no doubt about that.
Oh, yeah, that's true. And you know, I have to jump on the Sligo thing because Sligo was an incubator for me. I started going down there in eighth grade when I was 14. And, you know, there were guys down there in high school. I mean, guys like Eddie Peterson and Junior Jackson and Eddie Stewart from Blair and all the good players from Northwood at the time. And they had really good teams at the time. This is like 1970, 71. And these guys let me play with them. And that was the greatest gift that I could ever have gotten, was that these guys let me play. And the best thing that can happen to a young player is to play with older, bigger, stronger guys, because you learn how to survive and how to get by and how to get your shot off against bigger and taller people. And my parents used to drop me off at like 4 o'clock, 4:30, and come back and pick me up at like 10. Mm. And this is before I had a car. Mm-hmm. So the problem with that is that we lived about 15 minutes away. And sometimes it would pour rain at Sligo and not rain where my parents lived. So they wouldn't know that it's pouring down rain and there's no more hoop. And I'm under the house or the clubhouse there. It's like I'm just standing there getting soaked. But you know, it was great times down there at Sligo. Never forget those guys, those older guys who I'm still friends with. A lot of them today. I talk to Eddie Peterson all the time. To me, the greatest shooter that has ever come out of this area, in my opinion.
No question.
Talk to him every day. A lot of times, Buzzy Brayman is involved in our little text things. And, you know, like we talked about before, it'd be great to have those guys on. They've got some great stories. But, that's really where it started. And, you know, it just continued on like through the rest of high school.
And speaking of high school, talk about Blair, because you guys had – back then – the city was different, and all of your schools, your Spingarns, your Dunbars, your Easterns, Cardozo, just to name a few, had great teams, great players. And in order for a suburban school to get street cred, you had to be something. But you guys at Blair, which you weren't that far from the D.C. line, but you guys at Blair, especially in the mid-70s, 74, 75, you guys, when you would come to Jelliffe, you had what we would call street cred on the court. But talk about Blair, Coach Gene Doan, and, of course, your number two, the second-best rebounder for you, is Cedric Boatman. And we'll get to the top rebounder later on. In this interview, but I'll call Cedric Boatman your number two best rebounder.
Well, Cedric and I talk all the time. He's a dear friend of mine, and just a great guy. In fact, we did an interview a few weeks ago with Stacy Robinson's guy.
Arthur.
It was great.
Yes.
You know, Blair had good teams from like the early 60s all the way up through the late 70s. And to your point earlier, Doan was like a forward thinker. I mean, we had our preseason, we didn't scrimmage any county teams. We scrimmaged Mackin. We scrimmaged McKinley. We scrimmaged Coolidge. We scrimmaged Wilson. I mean, I still remember scrimmaging McKinley with Cricket. I remember scrimmaging Mackin when they had Keith Heron. Oh, my God, was he good. And Larry Heron, who I ended up playing with in men's league, one of the funniest guys you'll ever want to meet.
Oh, yeah.
Let's see, Mackin had, I guess when we scrimmaged them our senior year, they had JoJo.
JoJo but, as a junior.
JoJo was a junior, right? And our senior year, we scrimmaged Eastern. And, Butch, I'll tell you, there was 500 kids at that scrimmage from Blair. Because, our team that year, the school was so into our team. And behind that team, we had like 500 kids show up for a scrimmage. And Eastern had Turk, and they had Mike Morton, and they had Rodney Wright. Mm-hmm. And... Rat,
I
ended up playing with Rat in an AAU tournament in New Orleans, and he was
That's
only
right.
a 10th grader, I think, at the time.
That's right.
But, you know, playing against those guys and realizing that we could play with them, you know, I'm not saying that we could have beaten them in a real game, I mean, but we could have played with them. And so that gave us a lot of confidence, and you know, I think kudos to Coach Doan for you know having us go against the best competition like preseason. You know, back then the preseason was only like 3 weeks, 2.5, 3 weeks before you play your first game. So we're scrimmaging these really really tough teams, and I think that year we ended up fourth in the area behind DeMatha, Dunbar, and Eastern.
Yes, you did. And then that year you won the Maryland State Championship. talk about what was that like, winning the state championship? I think you defeated Duval in the championship game, correct?
Yeah, interestingly enough, the last time Blair had won the championship was in 69. It was against Duval also, who had a really good team. That Alfonso Adair was the big stud on that team. And we beat Duval in 75. It was a heck of a game. In fact, we were down by five with 4 minutes to go and scored the last 10 points of the game to win. But you know, Butch, Stacy and I talk, I think the mid-70s was the height of, like, high school basketball coverage by the media in this area. We had the Post, we had the Star in Montgomery County, we had the Sentinel and the Journal and the Record, and all these publications or these papers paid a lot of attention to high school sports, particularly basketball and football. And, you know, Cedric and I look back at our scrapbooks, and in 74-75, I mean, we were expected to win. So I looked at him the other day, and I said, man, it's a good thing we did, because we were heavily favored to win that year. It would have been a crusher not to come through.
I had last week I did an interview with Dickie Simpkins, and he was the class of, I think, 90. But we talked about the all-met class of 89, and that was a great class with, you know, Dickie and Grant Hill, Lawrence Moten, people like that. And you can debate that was one of the best all-met class. You know, the great Kurt Smith was a part of that all-met class.
Oh, yeah.
But as you stated, in the mid-70s, between 74 and 76, I think some of the best basketball ever was played in D.C. And you would go to the Jell-O Summer League on a night like tonight, early July, and you could easily see, if there were four games a night, you could easily see at least 10 or more Division I players on any given night at Jell-O.
Yeah, you know, and back then, Montgomery County only had an all-star team entry in the Jell-O League. We didn't have our school team. Yeah, I remember that well. I think our coach was Al Ferrara from Einstein. But man, what a great experience that was, going down there and playing against. I mean, Carroll had a team, DeMatha had a team. All the Catholic schools had their own team in there. So, I mean, maybe Virginia had an all-star team too. But playing on that little outdoor court behind the boys' club with the tennis court right behind it.
That's right.
I mean, that was great. That was a heck of an experience.
Mm-hmm. Brian Maggett is in the coach's corner. And, Brian, at what point in your career, at what age did you realize that you were blessed with a special talent, hand-eye coordination, the ability to put the ball in the basket? And at what point did you realize that? And talk to us on how you worked at it. Now, some people would say you spent 4 hours a day. I've heard the folklore of 8-9 hours a day. But talk to us on when you first discovered that you could put the ball in the basket, and what was your workout routine to enhance that God-given skill?
Well, I think growing up, I was a pretty good athlete. You put a ball in my hand, you put a racket in my hand or anything else, I was pretty good with it. I was a pretty good baseball player too. You know, I wasn't the quickest guy, the fastest guy. The guy could jump the highest, but, you know, with a ball or anything else, throwing a ball, catching a ball, shooting a ball, I was pretty good. And when you're pretty good, I think you can, unless you're, I don't know, like a, I don't want to say a freak, but unless you have somebody who shows you how to do something or how to practice or teaches you a skill above and beyond what your innate natural ability is, I'm not sure how much you can evolve that. And I was lucky enough to, when I was 14, meet Eddie Peterson. Eddie was 2-time All-Med at Springbrook.
Yeah.
Lefty recruited him, wanted him to go to Maryland. He ended up going to South Carolina. Now, Eddie's freshman year at South Carolina, he played on the freshman team with Brian Winters. And this was the freshman year, too, of Tom McMillan and Len Elmore at Maryland when freshmen couldn't play on varsity. Eddie averaged 29.4 points a game, shot like 54% from the field. I've got the stats to prove it. He was like a freak show, okay? Mm-hmm. Brian Winters, who played 8, 9, 10 years in the NBA, was a second leading scorer on that team. You know, there's a lot of guys who are considered like great shooters. Eddie, to me, is the best. Unfortunately, because of my friendship with Buzzy and I played a lot of pickup during high school. When I'm in 8th, 9th grade, he's in 10th, 11th, 12th, I'm in 10th. There was a rec center called Broad Acres, and the Springbrook guys used to come over there all the time. So I got to be friendly with Buzzy, and one day at Silver Spring Boys Club, he comes in with Eddie, and he introduces me to Eddie. Eddie worked with me for like 45 minutes, told me some things. When you're 14, you know, you're kind of listening, and I mean, I paid attention and all that, but a year later, I'm shooting around by myself, and I still remember the gym, and I still remember the shot, and everything that Eddie told me, okay, about why a basketball goes in the basket, it became clear to me. It was like an epiphany. And from that point on, it just became a different game for me, a different thing. That was when I was in 10th grade. And I think that's when my sort of passion for the game took off. And yeah, I spent a lot of hours in the gym, a lot of hours outside on the courts, shooting around, playing a lot. I mean, Eddie was the one who instilled sort of that thought process where you just can't play. You got to practice too.
So what did he, Brian, expound on for our listenership and for me? Because, you know, now the coach is coming out of me, love breaking down fundamentals of skill sets. So what did Eddie Peterson tell you about shooting? Was it the elbow under the ball, the fish hook finish, the getting your feet set, square to the basket? What did he tell you?
What Eddie told me was that he showed me how you can make the ball go where it's supposed to go. Basically, what he said was there's two reasons why the ball goes in. It's shot straight enough, and it's shot the right distance. And there's nobody alive who can explain to somebody else how hard to shoot a ball from any particular point. But he showed me how you can make the ball go straight. There's like three key things that you can do. Is always keep your eye on the spot on the rim that you want the ball to go over, number one. Number two, when you're finished, your follow-through should be right over that spot, okay? Mm-hmm. And the third thing is your release. If the ball comes off your fingers the way it's supposed to, and then there's a lot of other, like, intricacies going into this, like analyzing somebody's shot, but if those three things happen, the ball is going to be online. So what you're going to do is you're going to eliminate the misses to the left and to the right. Mm-hmm. And then it's just going to be a matter of distance, long or short. And okay. Then he said, look, there's good misses and there's bad misses. any miss to the left or to the right, then you didn't do what you're supposed to do. Okay. You don't want to miss to the right or the left because then the ball doesn't have a chance of going in. If you, the ball is shot straight, it always has a chance of going in.
That's right.
And that's basically what he taught me. We didn't really talk too much about form or technique because he didn't have a lot of time. I think he spent maybe 30 or 45 minutes with me. I think my shot at the time was probably fundamentally correct, so to speak. So he didn't feel the need to change anything. Mm-hmm. But just knowing in your mind that, like, this idea that you can make the ball go where you want it to go was eye-opening for me.
Mm-hmm. But now I would ask the question, and I know a lot of our listeners are asking the question in their minds. That's great. But how much of this was God-given, and how much was the fundamentals and the repetition?
Well, you know, I'm of the mind, Coach, that if you can already do something well, that you're more inclined to be able to improve than someone who say, can't do something well at all. Okay.
Right.
You know, given that I was already a pretty good natural shooter, I mean, some players have a feel. Some players have to develop a feel. I mean, if you already have a feel for shooting and a feel for, say, distance control and all that, I think that your ability to improve is greater than somebody else who doesn't have that natural sort of feel for it.
Mm-hmm.
So I would say that a lot of it is natural and God-given, but you have to be able to enhance it and work on it and develop it if you're going to reach your potential.
Yeah.
And then so that brings into – that brings passion and commitment into it. And you can't make somebody love something if they don't already.
That's right.
It's hard to, I mean, you can't tell a kid to go out and practice 5 hours a day if he doesn't want to, you know, but those kids who want to, or those players who want to do that, those are the ones, and if those guys are the ones who learn the right way to do things, and repetition, doing things the right way over and over and over again, those are the ones who are going to improve the most.
Mm-hmm. Now we've talked about repetition. We've talked about fundamentals. And also we've talked about the God-given hand-eye coordination. But there's one other component, I believe, Brian, in being a top-flight shooter, and that's the mindset. That's the confidence of believing that every single shot you take is going in. Now, of course, every shot you take is not going in, but most good shooters, or I'd say all good shooters, absolutely believe that every shot they take, it's going in, and they want the ball in crunch time. 5 seconds to go, they want it. Some people hide, other people step up. Talk about the mindset and the mental approach of seeing that ball go in every single time.
Well, I think that confidence is born out of the fact of how much time you've put into it. And realizing,
good,
you know,
point,
having the self-awareness that you're good at this and you're not afraid. I mean, I guess it goes back, like, people ask me, like, how did you go in and you know, you haven't played all game and you know, he wants you to make a shot. Well, I mean, that's because I worked on it. I hours and hours and hours and tens of thousands of shots, and if that's how you develop the confidence. You know, there's also false confidence. Players who haven't put the time in, who think they can go in and make shots when, you know, they haven't dedicated their time or their practice time, their commitment to it, and still have the confidence, but don't have the, say, the ability or the wherewithal to make it happen. I mean, there's sort of false confidence too. Those are the kind of kids that you don't want shooting at the end of a game.
No,
oh, yeah,
you don't.
Sure, coach, I can make it.
Brian, and again, I jokingly said that Cedric Boatman was your number two rebounder because your number one rebounder at the time was your girlfriend who would rebound your shots in the gym, correct?
Well, I kid Cedric that he may be the number one all-time leading rebounder of missed shots at Blair,
mm-hmm.
but my old girlfriend, Roseanne, is the number one all-time rebounder of made shots, like by a long shot. She used to rebound for me all the time. It was great. It was great. Danny Harwood and I, the coach of Magruder, he's the all-time winningest
yeah.
coach in Montgomery County. He's been a Magruder
great
for 30-some years. Great coach, great guy. I see him all the time. We play pickleball. We play tennis together. We kid around, and we tell our players, because I help his son coach the JV at Magruder, Timmy.
Mm-hmm.
We kid around all the time with players. He goes, man, you got to get a girlfriend who's willing to rebound for you.
That's
not
right.
going to rebound. She can't be your girlfriend.
That's right. Okay, you win a state championship. Your first team all met, as we said, in 75. And you have a lot of the top schools. You have Duke. You have Kentucky. You have Dean Smith at UNC. But you select Maryland. Talk about why you selected Maryland. And in hindsight, here we go. In hindsight, if you had a do-over, would you still make the same selection?
Well, hindsight is 20/20. Obviously, that's a common thing. And
sure,
you know what? I can't tell you what I was thinking at the time, but I know subconsciously that I was going to go to Maryland. I visited Duke. I visited William & Mary. I visited Georgetown. I could have visited Kentucky. Could have visited Hawaii, Stanford, and you know. Honest to goodness, the reason that I didn't go on those visits was because I didn't want to be away from the gym for 3 days. I mean,
wow.
All these visits were in the fall.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, this was back in the days when you could take unlimited visits.
Right.
You know? So every weekend, you know, you could have been going here and there, but that meant that you couldn't play. I mean, nowadays – from what I understand, you can visit a school and actually play with the team sometimes or play while you're there. Back then it wasn't like that. And there was no way that I was going to go Friday, Saturday, and Sunday without picking up a ball. So I think subconsciously I was always going to go there. You know, I spent a lot of time there my senior year at Blair, going over and playing with those guys. And, you know, it's just one of those things. Now, to your question, would I do it all over again?
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely.
And excuse me, Brian, I ask that because today, young players, when they are looking at a school, they're looking at how can I get on the court immediately after I arrive at the school, okay, starting from day one.
Uh-huh.
In your situation, you knew that John Lucas had a year, Mo Howard had a year, and so you knew that at least 1 year you would be coming off the bench, but you still made the decision to attend University of Maryland.
Right. And you know, a lot of that too. I mean, I transferred to GW after Maryland.
Yes.
I've always been kind of like a hometown guy. I don't think I would have been happy going away to school. But, I mean, to somebody else, it may look like, gosh, you should have gone, you know, here, should have gone there. My friend, hey, you should have gone to Duke, should have gone to North Carolina. It's like, no. I tell everyone it's the second best decision I ever made going to Maryland.
Mm-hmm. And the best decision you made was going to George Washington.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Now that's not to slight my decision to go to Maryland. I mean, mm-hmm. second best decision I ever made. But going to mm-hmm. GW was the best. I mean, I got an opportunity to play high level D1. Mm-hmm. Had a decent junior year and a pretty good senior year. I loved playing for Bob Talent. To this day, he's one of my dear friends. I got a lot of other friends at GW I still keep in touch with. And, it was just a great 3 years there. And the year I sat out, I got to do the games on the radio with Johnny Holiday.
Yeah. Now, at the time when you went to Maryland, was Will Jones assistant coach then?
Will came my sophomore year when JoJo and Billy came as freshmen.
Mm-hmm.
We had a lot of great horse games.
That's why I brought it
Coach
up.
Dillon.
I would have paid to watch a horse game between Brian Maggett and Coach Will Jones, because Will Jones was one of the original great shooters. I'm talking about an original great shooter, and he would tell you how great he was, and he would back it up. But boy, I can imagine the horse games, and you guys are shooting from all over, from the popcorn stand at the old Coalfield House.
Well, I mean, no kidding. He was he had a freak show shot. He could shoot from 30, 35 feet without any difficulty at all. He'd shoot it like a 15 or a 20 footer. It was incredible. The only other guy I've seen with natural range like that was Archie Talley.
Oh yeah, Hats, my man.
But Will Jones, what a great guy, funny guy, what a character, mm-hmm. charismatic, funny. Went on to have a great career. You say you'd pay to watch a horse game. I'd pay to see highlight films of him playing in college.
Oh yeah.
I wonder if
just one of the great shooters. And at one point, one of the other things that you and Coach Will Jones had in common, I think Will had a streak of, I think it was something like 80 consecutive made free throws, and then you had a streak. You talked about shooting the shot from the perimeter, but now let's talk about the dynamics of shooting a free throw. And what I would always teach my players was, as soon as the official hands you the ball, you don't look down, okay? As soon as you get the ball, you get into a routine. Three dribbles, a breath, bend your knees, you set it up, and you let it go. And then you would do the Adrian Dantley, follow through, over the rim, backspin, follow through.
Okay, well, yeah, I mean, the routine of a free throw is different for everybody, but I think the most important thing is that when you go to the line, that you don't think about anything but that free throw. A lot of players get like caught up in the game and thinking about other things instead of just shooting the free throw. I had a streak of 45 in a row, which coincidentally had tied Coach Talent from when he was at GW, when he averaged like 29 a game in 1969. And we went up to Villanova to play Raleigh Massimino's team, and they had a player named Tom Sinkiewicz, and him and I were neck and neck in the nation for like the top one and two free throw percentages. And we had a shoot around the day before the game, and a Philadelphia news team came and did a thing, a spot on it for a pregame. Well, wouldn't you know, Butch, that I missed three free throws in that game?
Wow, three.
Three free throws. And, you know, I can't blame it on the rims or anything, because I think I was 12 for 18 from the field that game, but 2 for 5 from the line. So, needless to say, I think their NCAA record at the time was 63 in a row by some guy named Tom Lloyd from Rutgers. But, you know, I was within spitting distance of it, but unfortunately it didn't happen.
Now, just in the gym, shooting off the top of your head, if you can recall, how many shots, consecutive shots, from the field that you have made, and how many consecutive free throws that you've made in the gym?
Well, I can tell you how many free throws. I made 399 in a row once.
In a row?
And then I missed. And then I missed one, and then hit another 200, and then missed another one. But you know, I mean, that sounds impressive until you look and see that some guy made like over 2,000 in a row, you know? but yeah, you know, I mean, I think the main thing about free throw shooting is, and you can say the same thing about shooting a jumper. If you're practicing something wrong and you do it a lot, you're just repeating something that is not working. You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
So it's important that you feel, or you get lucky enough that someone tells you that you might have a certain flaw, so you can stop practicing something the wrong way, or something in your technique is flawed, but you keep doing it over and over and over, you know? So
mm-hmm.
I think that, you know, those players who were lucky enough to have somebody point out to them, like I was with Eddie, and you know, Eddie taught Buzzy, Eddie taught Craig Eschrick, you know, all great shooters. And then Buzzy, of course, went on to be, you know, the shot doctor, the number one sort of NBA shot doctor guy, had an assistant coaching job with the Bulls.
Let me say this, and again, this is my story that I always tell, that I witnessed this. This is the summer 1974 at the Ron Watts Jewish Community Center basketball camp, and I'm working with Ron Watts, John Thompson, Buzzy Brayman. You come over last day of camp, and you and Buzzy have a shootout. And, of course, Buzzy was one of the top shooters, and I'd never heard of you. But, man, you guys, I'd never witnessed anything like it. You guys started from around the elbow, and as I always say, you ended up shooting jumpers on Rockville Pike. But that day, I mean, it was clearly your day shooting. Talk about that day, and can you share with us other shooting contests? Because back then, being a great shooter was almost being like a gunslinger in the West, that everybody wanted to have a showdown with you.
You know, shooting contests, I mean, I know that Eddie and I used to have them with a lot of the guys who played pickup. To be honest with you, I have a vague recollection of that Ronnie Watts camp with Buzzy. I mentioned it to him a few months ago, and he didn't remember it. But the fact that we were friends and had known each other for like 2 or 3 years at the time and had played a lot with and against each other, I'm sure it was a good-natured kind of competition. But, you know, shooting around when no one's on you and you're practicing, I mean, the best shooting days I can remember from, like that don't involve a game or speaking at camps. When I'm speaking in front of a bunch of kids for 30 or 35 minutes and sort of the adrenaline's flowing and you know what you're talking about and you're shooting while you're talking. I did a camp for Coach Hibbs at Good Counsel about 12 years ago. And a friend of my daughter's was working at the camp, and she called my daughter up. He called my daughter up that night. He goes, "Janet, your dad here, or your dad was here giving a talk on shooting, and he shot for 45 minutes and missed four shots in 45 minutes." I'm like, and so my daughter asked me about that, and I said, "Jenny, I got to be honest with you. I don't think I have ever felt better shooting a basketball than at that Good Counsel camp today." So, you know, if you know how to do something, and you're teaching it, there's a certain adrenaline and excitement that you're giving something to these kids, and if they're paying attention, that maybe they can get it too. So, that's really what I feel like has been my sort of gift to give back, is hopefully that kids can learn from me and maybe go on and have a little bit of success of their own.
Brian Maggett is in the Coach's Corner. Brian, why do you think that you didn't get more playing time at the University of Maryland? Because, again, the plan was after Lucas and Howard graduated, then you would be the starting two guard. But then the next year, JoJo Hunter comes in, Billy Bryant comes in. I think Turk Tillman was there. So was it a matter of you getting lost in the shuffle, or Coach wanted to get just more athleticism and not utilize your special weapon?
Yeah, I think it was a combination of both. You know, JoJo was a great, great player. Billy was a great, great player. You know, Turk. I mean, Turk may have been the most athletic player I've ever like shared a court with. I mean, he was like I like to say a freak show. I mean, people don't realize when he left Maryland the same time I did, he went to Eastern Kentucky and was like the fourth leading scorer in the country. I think averaged like 27 or 28 a game for 2 years in a row. But you know, these were great players, great athletes. And, you know, we all sort of played the same position. You know, Brad was there playing point guard. So, you know, the two guard, it was me, it was JoJo. You know, Billy played swing a little bit. Turk could swing or play the two. So yeah, there's only so many minutes you can get.
You
and
know,
it's just
I,
one of those things.
Brian, I always felt, and I love Coach Giselle. He was on one of my first podcast shows. His son Chuck and I are really good friends. Chuck is doing a fantastic job at my old program, Moray. But I've always said that I felt that Coach Giselle was underrated as a coach, because people thought he was just a recruiter, but I thought he was a very good coach. And I thought he was a little overrated as a recruiter. And what I meant by that was he would get the big names, but he would recruit, in my opinion, too much of the same thing.
Well, you know, if you look back maybe at the box scores and stuff, I was looking at the scrapbooks the other day, and he didn't like to play more than seven guys, sometimes even six.
Yeah.
And if you weren't one of those six or seven guys, then you know, unless somebody was really stinking up the place or got hurt or something like that, then there weren't a whole lot of minutes to be had. So, you know, just one of those things. I mean, the one, I don't want to call it a regret, but the one sort of issue I have was I played really, really well against Notre Dame in the opener my sophomore year. And we lost to Notre Dame by a couple of points. And I played 26 minutes in that game, played really well. I guarded Donald Williams that game.
Duck.
Maybe I'm sure he was Duck. I'm sure he was just off. But you know, he didn't have too good of a game. And I had I had 14 points and four or five assists or something like that. Shot the ball really well. And then I didn't play
the point guard or the two guard.
I'm sorry?
I said, were you playing the point or the off guard?
Oh no! I was playing two. Brad Davis was.
Brad Davis,
the point.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, and the next, it was a game or two later. We played LIU, and we only ended up winning by 3 points. I think it was a low scoring game. They played a zone, and I remember in the paper the next day, the coach of LIU says, yeah, I'm glad we didn't face that or that Maggot kid didn't play much because we thought he was going to be a problem after scouting Notre Dame. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it is what it is. I hate that phrase, but, you know, it worked out the way it did. I don't regret going to Maryland. I loved playing there for 2 years. I loved, like, my freshman year playing against Lucas and those guys in practice. And even my sophomore year was fun. So no regrets, man. No regrets.
And then you transfer, as we mentioned briefly, to George Washington University. People will say, well, you know what? The first thing that most interviews and the interviewer will say, I bet, Brian, is, man, you were born a little too soon. But the reality of it is that during your career at George Washington, it was the first year of the 3-point arc in the NBA, and you got an offer to try out. Talk about that experience.
Well, yeah. Well, that is when they had 10 rounds in the draft. I can't remember how many teams they had. Maybe 20 back then in 1980, 22. So, yeah. I mean, I had a reputation as a shooter, and Indiana just took a shot and drafted me in the 8th round. I mean, I didn't give it any thought about going. I mean, come on. I was not good enough to play in the NBA, particularly at that time. And, but it was cool to get drafted. I mean, my friends all dug it and thought it was neat, you know? Yeah, it was an honor. I mean, hey, you got drafted in the NBA. And then I played the next year and, had a pretty good season. And, I went down and played in the Portsmouth Invitational and played pretty well down there and got hooked up with an agent, and he talked to the Pacers, and they ended up giving me, like, you know, $5,000 not to go back into the draft that year.
Okay, so which was pretty good money back then.
Yeah, why not? I mean, he came up with a list of, like, 4 teams that looked like, you know, I had the best chance of making whatever, and the Pacers were one of them. So he thought, look, you know, if they're going to give you $5,000, let's go there. And, you know, the guy was on the level, too. He didn't charge me a cent. He goes, look, if you make it, then we'll talk about a contract. But, yeah, it was fun.
Do you believe if, you know, playing the what-if game just for the sake of this interview, do you believe if you were coming along today with your game, the same way you played, you were, what were you, about 6'2", maybe 6'3"?
6'2".
Yeah, 6'2". With the you know, the openness of the game, meaning that now everyone, they practice, they work on taking the three-point shot. Do you believe that if Brian Magid was coming along today, that you could be a first or late first or early second round draft pick the way you could shoot the ball?
You know, I don't think so. I think that, I mean, if I would have had even a smidgen of a chance in today's game, the circumstances would have to be like absolutely perfect. You know, a team needs a guy on the bench who's, I don't know, come on, like a Steve Kerr type guy.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe if I could put my 40-year-old head on my 22-year-old body back then maybe, yeah, because, I mean, I think I played the best basketball I ever played between 40 and 50, to be honest with you.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, you're not the same physically because you're older, but I think I was a way, way better player in my 40s than I was in my 20s.
How do you like the way the game is played today? I mean, if you were a coach, or, you know, I'm sure you follow the game, but what are some of the things that you like about today's game and some of the things that you don't like about the way the game is played today?
Well, I'm an old school guy, coach. You know, I like big men. I loved Kareem. I loved Wilt. I loved the Dream. And I'm a huge fan of the mid-range game, too. And that's pretty much gone these days. You know, there's teams who don't have any traditional big men. There's teams who play a style where, you know, mid-range jumper, it doesn't exist. I mean, you look at a shot chart of the Houston Rockets sometimes, and it's all threes and it's all layups, literally.
Mm-hmm.
I still love to watch, but I don't find it as intriguing as I used to. I mean, I loved guys like Pierce and Michael Jordan and Phil Chenier and Oscar and Clyde, you know, all these guys who could do things in between the 3-point line and the foul line, you know? The game has changed. I mean, let's face it, even all the way down to high school, even at Magruder, we emphasize the 3-pointer and layups.
Can you still shoot it?
And
Brian, can you still shoot it? Can you still get out? And I remember when I was coaching into my 50s, and I could still shoot, okay? I could still beat just about everybody in free throws and shoot. I couldn't do anything else. But at right now, at your age, can you still put the ball in the basket? I bet you can.
Oh, shooting around, absolutely. In fact, one of the downfalls of this virus thing was we have a beautiful gym at work, and I have two new knees, but I used to go over to the gym every day and shoot around for about half an hour, 45 minutes before I'd go do my workout. And, you know, shoot around with the kids sometimes at Magruder. You know, it's one thing to shoot around. I mean, you can't play anymore, you know, if you can't run. But shooting around, absolutely. Yeah.
We've got about 5 or 6 more minutes left. Got just a couple more questions now. Here's something that I'm going to pull out left field, but I've always been so intrigued as a player. The only thing I could do pretty decent as a player was I could shoot the ball, couldn't do anything else. And as a coach, I always admired guys who could shoot. But how many shots could you make from the free throw line with your eyes closed?
Out of how many? Oh, gosh.
Let's say, now, and I asked the question. Now, some people maybe never played or don't understand. They're saying, well, why would he ask that? The people who have played, especially shooters, know that you've probably practiced on your own shooting with your eyes closed.
Well, do you get to like load up halfway and then close?
Yes. Yes.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I can make a good amount.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, you know, if you visualize the rim there, but I mean, you just go through the regular flow and you've done it enough. It's all feel. I mean, I can't say that was a staple of my practice routine, to be honest, but, yeah, it's repetition and it's follow through and yeah, it's doing the same thing over and over and over again. Yeah. You can do it with your eyes closed. Now, not if you close them, like, you know, before you dribble three times, then it's tough.
Right.
But, you know, you have
once you set it up and then close your eyes, yeah.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. One of the things that I always had a lot of admiration and respect for you was, and you alluded to this earlier in the interview, you loved the game. No one had more love and enthusiasm and passion for the game of basketball than Brian Magid, but you knew at some point that a career in terms of high school, college, and professional would come to an end, but you were okay with that. And I've heard you say that, hey, you know what? Playing in the adult league satisfied that basketball itch that I had. A lot of people can't do that. When that ball stops bouncing and the crowd stops roaring, it's a tough adjustment, but not so with you. Talk about why.
Well, I think, I mean, self-awareness is a great trait to have, you know, and it's, I mean, I was aware that I was just not good enough to make it in the league. I mean, I can tell you right now, when I was in the Pacers camp, and by the way, Billy Bryant was at that camp too. It was a rookie camp. That was great to see him down there then. I played really well over my head for like 3 days, and I knew it. I'm like, I can't keep this up for like, you know, however long, but they were going to give me money not to go back into the draft. So I took it, but I thought to myself, man, but the last night we were there and we were at the Bradley Fieldhouse where they filmed Hoosiers. This is where the camp was. And a couple of the Pacers came up that night, and we played with them, and one of them was Johnny Davis, and I was guarding him for about 5 minutes. Well, guarding him is an overstatement or an understatement. You know, I pretty much watched him go by. I thought John Lucas was quick and had jets, but oh man, I'm like, wow, this guy. If this is what it's like, you know, I don't have a chance. And, you know, I'm not saying that was the, like, you know, realization that I had a thing there. Oh, I'm not going to. But, you know, it dawned on me, man, this is not going to be this might not happen. So, I mean, I was okay with it. But you know what, Coach, I was blessed after playing college and not making the NBA, I played overseas in Israel for a few months, but I played a lot of adult league ball with a lot of great, great, great guys like Tony Upson and
yep.
Lloyd Mays.
Oh yeah,
and Bill Rubach and Spinny Johnson, and we had a team with the Dancing Crab. I don't know if you know. Do you know Zeke Zimmerman?
Zeke Zimmerman, absolutely. Interviewed the mayor of Chevy Chase.
Oh, so Zeke, yeah, I played with Zeke and those guys. And, I mean, we had Larry Heron a couple of years. We had Merlin Wilson.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, Tony's like a legend. Tony and Lloyd are legends in this town.
Absolutely.
And playing with – and Spinny, come on, playing with these guys for 10 years in men's league was just a joy. And, you know, then after that, we had our old dogs league for a long time. And I don't know, Butch, the greatest thing about having a life in basketball, number one, is it's really great to be remembered, and that maybe, like, you know, you had an impact on people as far as
as
they had fun watching you and you made them happy. But for me to, like, you know, still have a relationship with guys like Stacey Robinson and you know, a few years ago before my knees went south, I was playing in the DC 50 and over league and with guys like Delonte Taylor and Justin Ellis, may he rest in peace. And, you know, that's just, I mean, the relationships that you make if you stay in this game or what's made it all worth it.
No question. And we've got about 2 minutes left, and I'm looking at a photo, and I don't know what year this was. I'm assuming it was the 70s, maybe early 80s. But do I see Brian Maggett in the company of the greatest Muhammad Ali?
Oh, yeah. Oh, talk about – oh, yeah. See, now, if I didn't go to Maryland, I never would have met the greatest. So – we had our Maryland basketball banquet at the Sheraton in Lanham in 76, May of 76. And Ali was getting ready to fight Jimmy Young at Cap Center. And I always heard the story was that Lefty heard Ali was in the hotel and brought him down. And we had a guest speaker all set up. But when Ali came down, he actually spoke at our banquet. And he was in the salt. I mean, that picture that you see, those are silk pajamas, like button silk pajamas. That brown shirt he's got on is a.
That's right.
And, oh, man, he couldn't have been more gracious and nice. Took pictures with everybody. I mean, how many people get an opportunity to meet Ali and to have pictures taken with him? That was just awesome.
Well, speaking of just awesome, how many people get a chance to talk basketball and shooting with the guy that was once said that he shoots the ball with a postage stamp on it? Because, you know, like when you put a postage stamp, you know where it's going to end up, and that's how you shot it. And, Brian, we've got about 30 seconds. I always ask our guests to leave our listeners with parting shots. We call it wow, words of wisdom.
Words of wisdom. If you have a passion for something, go for it, because you never know the places it's going to take you. Little did I know that, like, you know, playing basketball as a kid would take my life in a direction where pretty much all my friends, except for the ones I grew up with, are somehow related to basketball. And that has been such a blessing. I mean, I'm blessed to have been a part of this game. I'm blessed that people remember me. And I thank everyone who comes up to me and says, man, I used to love to watch you play, because that just makes me feel so good. And one last shout out to Eddie Peterson.
Yeah.
I've had a lot of opportunities in the last year or so to tell him how much he's meant to me. And I know for a fact that we wouldn't be having this conversation now if I hadn't met Eddie. So he's my man. And, you know, that's about it.
And look, man, you talk about relationships. Before the interview, the great Stacey Robinson called and said, Coach, make sure you tell Brian Maggett, I said, hello. And I said, well, from one guy who could put the ball in the basket to another guy who could put the ball in the basket.
Stacy, the only guy I have ever seen come down on a break and shoot a 360 jump shot from the elbow.
and at one point when he went over to the bathroom, Coach Wooten blew the whistle and said, hey, we don't have enough mustard for that hot dog. or Brian, as I used to tell my players, hey, of course, I never coached anybody with the great athleticism of a Stacey Robinson, but I would say, son, plain cake, no icing, plain cake. Hey, Brian, this has been fantastic, man. Thank you so much, and really enjoyed the visit here in the Coach's Corner, talking about the art of shooting, and no one No one could shoot that thing better than our guest tonight, Brian Maggett. Thanks, man.
Well, thanks, Coach. I appreciate it. Enjoyed it very much. Thanks again.
All right, folks, and hope you enjoyed the visit with Brian Maggett. And as always, our sponsors, we want to thank Horton's Funeral Service, over 80 years, simply the best, 202-829-9000, 202-829-9000, Randolph Horton, a.k.a. Reds Bowman. And in need of any dental care is Dr. Edward T. Buford, 202-667-8818. They're located on U Street, right next to Ben's Chili Bowl. And the Athletic Republic, that's the old run and shoot. Not open yet, but hopefully they will be reopening very soon. And don't forget to visit the AfricanAmericanAthlete.com for this interview tomorrow. And all of the previous interviews in the Coach's Corner, go to the AfricanAmericanAthlete.com. And also you can plug in some of the writings and the interviews of my producer, Rick Hampton Sr. Well, folks, we will see you tomorrow, and we got a big surprise for the Coach's Corner tomorrow. I'm not going to tell you. You need to tune in, but I'm going to say you don't want to miss it at 7 p.m. But until then, make good decisions, because life is hard, but it's even harder